I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, you've got 60 seconds to plan the perfect night. Are you mixing up Bullet Bourbon Old Fashions by the fire, sipping Kettle One Martinis at a house party, or toasting Don Julio Reposado while planning a tropical vow renewal for your dogs? The answer is yes, because with Drizzly, the go-to app for drink delivery, you can find the right drink for any occasion. Sending a gift to family, friends, or coworkers, hosting an ugly sweater party, restocking your bar, you name it, and you can find the drinks for it on Drizzly. Then get them delivered to your or their door. Not sure what to get? Build your own gift registry to get the gifts you want, or take a guided gifting quiz to make sure everyone on your list gets what they want. So,
what's it gonna be?
Download the Drizzly app or go to drizzly.com. That's drizly.com to choose your drinks today. Must be 21 plus, not available in all locations.
It's the most wonderful time of the year, Christmas. And what better way to get into the holiday spirit than with a Minky Couture blanket? Whether you're gathered around the tree with loved ones, roasting marshmallows by the fire, or just looking for a cozy way to stay warm on a chilly night, Minky blankets are the perfect addition to your Christmas festivities. With a wide range of festive designs and colors, you can find the perfect blanket to match your holiday decor or gift to your loved ones. So this Christmas, make your holiday even cozier with a Minky Couture blanket. Head to MinkyCouture.com now and find your perfect blanket just in time for the holiday. Happy holidays from Minky Couture.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Rachel Fisher.
And I'm Desi Jenikin.
And we're the hosts of Hollywood Crime Scene. We're really excited to announce that we're launching a new podcast called Bitch Slap, where we explore one of our passions, nighttime soaps.
Every week, we will be recapping episodes of a classic nighttime soap, starting with one of the greatest shows of all time, Melrose Place.
That's Bitch Slap. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
So, Dave Simpson, welcome. You're a Guardian music critic and journalist, and of course, author, and your books include The Fallen, In and Out of Britain's Most Insane Group, the story, of course, of The Fall, and the book we're going to talk about today, Sex Pistols, I Want to Be Me. But first, I want to start a little bit with you and your early life and what music meant to you growing up.
Oh, blimey. It was kind of everything. I mean, it really was everything from probably about the age of six, I think. I don't think this is uncoincidental. My dad died when I was six, and he'd got me into music in a way by, he was a pianist at the, he was like, played piano at the Working Men's Club nearby, and he sometimes would take me down there, and he bought me a little piano. But he also introduced me, they had a drummer called Jeff, who had a Beverly Red Sparkle drum kit, and who gave me a pair of drumsticks. And that felt like quite a moment. I did get a drum kit, but probably about 10 years later. But I kept the sticks, you know, and eventually I did use those sticks, and that felt like a kind of ceremonial thing. So I didn't have that much interest in the piano, but after Dad died, I just found that pop music really spoke to me. You know, I mean, before that, I remember Dad getting me into stuff like How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? And Puff the Magic Dragon was another song that I loved when I was really little. But once it was just me and my mum, before I went to school on a morning, I'd listen to like Tony Blackburn's show on Radio 1 back then. And he'd placed all the, I suppose it was like the beginnings of glam rock and Philadelphia soul music as well. But certain records just really, really leapt out that spoke to my situation, like Alone Again Naturally by Gilbert O'Sullivan. A record called All By Myself.
Who's Eric Carmen.
Eric Carmen. That's right. John Miles' Music Was My First Love, It Will Be My Last. All these sort of things kind of spoke to me as a sort of little kid trying to make sense of where his dad had gone, you know. But also stuff like Slade. I got so into Slade. I remember hearing Cos I Love You on Tony Blackburn. That was the first one of theirs I heard. And around the same time, I heard Ride a White Swan by T-Rex. And there was something really off-kilter about those records that I couldn't quite... nothing I'd heard before sounded like them. And then, you know, dare I say it, Gary Glitter as well with the Glitter Stomp. You know, those three groups really crashed into my world, really. And I can vividly... I mean, I lived in a semi-detached house on a council estate in North Leeds. And I vividly remember kind of trying to imagine what it would be like if there were like enormous, like 40-foot speakers on the top of every house that would play Take Me Back Home by Slade at deafening volume. Sadly, Leeds Council never installed anything like that. But I did used to, when I got a Fidelity record player for my, I think about 9th or 10th birthday, something like that. And so suddenly I could play records. And I didn't have any albums, but I had singles, and I used to play them very, very loudly. And finally, I got the Slade album, where they're like this on the front cover with the SLAD written across the hand. And that was the only album I owned for 5 years. But I used to play that all the time when I got home from school. That would go straight on and play a reasonable volume. I also had a Top of the Pops album, which was kind of the hits of the day performed by people in Holland, I believe. So you had kind of facsimile versions of stuff like Metal Guru by T-Rex and, oh, I can't remember what else was on there, but though, I didn't really count that because it wasn't a proper album. Slade was the only real album I had. And actually the next album I bought after that was Nevermind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols 5 years later, you know. So... I did buy singles. I bought, you know, I couldn't afford to buy albums basically with my pocket money, but I could afford to buy the occasional single. And so I had about 3 or 4 T-Rex singles. I had several Slade singles. Billy Ocean, Love Really Hurts Without You. I went through a Motown period. I went through a kind of, not really disco period, but I suppose the beginnings of disco records with a bit slightly more dancey groove. Just singles really, but I was an avid listener to the radio. I listened to the radio all the time.
When did you first hear about the Sex Pistols at all?
Well, the first time I heard them, I was at school and I was stood outside the swimming pool. We were queuing up to go in the swimming pool with school, and there was a lad in class called Mark Chivers from London, or rather, I don't really know the full story of his family situation, but his dad lived in London, and his dad was, I think, as I remember it, his dad was some kind of vicar or priest or something. And he'd gone to stay with his dad that summer. So he came back from London and he was telling us in the queue about this group called the Sex Pistols, that the singer did handstands and vomited on stage. And this sounded incredibly exciting. I've never been able to verify that either of these things ever happened. You know, I think the vomiting is at least plausible. Maybe it happened once. Handstands, can't really see that. I can't see Johnny Rotten or John Lydon as now doing handstands on stage. No, I'm not having that. I doubt very much that he'd seen them. I suspect he'd probably heard this about sixth hand or something. But it was obvious that there was something going on. The other thing I remember is he suddenly arrived in school with his, he'd cut his hair like sort of Sid Vicious's. He had a fantastic Sid Vicious haircut, actually, and would actually stand out in the rain, giggling in the pouring rain to make his hair look better. But he suddenly turned up on this top and they had Mark Mutilation written on the back of it. So he'd become a punk. So it was quite exciting, really. There was obviously something going on, even though I wasn't quite sure what it was. And then the same boy brought in, the timeline sort of confuses me a bit. And I think the first incident must have been in 1976. And then probably it must have been a few months later that he brought in Anarchy in the UK, which I believe would have been, it could have even been the A&M or the first early version of it or something. But I think it was Anarchy in the UK, and he played it in the music class. And because we were allowed to play our own records at the end, the teacher would make us listen to Elgar and Beethoven and things like that. And then right at the end, we were allowed to put on our own records. So I would put on, probably something like Mississippi by a Dutch band called Pussycat that was number one for about 11 years, or it felt like it. That was the last record I bought before punk. And then Chivzy brought in Anarchy in the UK and put it on. And it was like, what the heck is this? It sounded incredible. The lyrics didn't register at all. It was the chord change. It was something about that descending. I'm not a guitarist, but something about the chord changes of it and the pattern of it and the excitement of it. I just thought, what the heck is this? And within, again, I'm not quite clear on the timing, but it felt very sudden that suddenly there were about half a dozen of us at school that would go into a little room with a red light and we would listen to stuff like In the City by the Jam, Looking After Number One by the Boomtown Rats, who are not really seen as a cool punk group now, but at the time they were part of our early initiation, I suppose, into punk. And me and another lad called Richard Breakspear, I think his name was, that we all started doing things with our hair, you know, like cutting our hair and trying to make it go up a bit. You know, there was a friend of mine was from Nigeria, and he used to have a, you know, kind of small afro, and he had this like sheep's lanolin, and I said, Tayo, can I borrow some of that, you know? And he would lend me this stuff and sort of put my hair up a bit, you know. And of course we thought this was tremendously exciting. But then we three of us went to see the Jam, and we didn't realize that you needed tickets to get in. You couldn't just sort of rock up, you know. I think we'd assume that you could. I mean, we were so naive and so young. This is like 13 years old or something, 12, 13 years old. As I remember it, we just didn't even realize that you would need tickets. So we get down there and we haven't got tickets. And there's this massive queue of people. We've gone, you know, looking kind of punky. We'd sort of cut up our uniforms and put ink and stuff on stuff. And we thought we looked punky, and they just laughed at us, you know, because all the crowd are there in, like, you know, cardigans and flares with long hair. They were not punks. They were hippies. You know, I don't think punk had really got far from London back at that point. And so we never got into the gig, but we did make it into the sound check for at least 30 seconds. And I can vividly remember the sight of the shoes. I said, there were Paul Weller and Bruce Function. I remember the shoes. And then suddenly we were being thrown out, you know, and there was a policeman outside asking us what we were doing and all the rest of it. You know, it was quite nice, actually, the policeman. You know, it wasn't exactly, you know, a clash with authority. It was quite friendly. He just asked us what on earth we were doing, you know. And we said, we tried to get in because we haven't got tickets. So I failed miserably to see any of the, you know, punk bands at that. I was too young, really. And then I do vividly remember Christmas 1970. It must have been Christmas 77. An advert in the Yorkshire Evening Post for the Sex Pistols at Huddersfield, Ivanhoe's, I now know. I don't remember it as being Ivanhoe's, but I remember it being Huddersfield, and saying to my mum, can I go to this? You know, and she was like, don't be ridiculous. You know, there's no way you are going It was in another town. You know, it wasn't even in Leeds. You know, it would have been a real journey, and I was just not allowed to do it. And annoyingly, I don't think I knew this at the time, but they did two shows. They did a matinee show for under 14s, I think it was, and then a sort of adult show. And so the matinee show in the afternoon, I think I could have gone to that. You know, if I'd have known it was in the afternoon, or if I'd have worked it out, maybe my mum would have let me, because we didn't have a car or anything. You know, I would have had to get a bus, a train, then another train, then probably a bus. You know, it would have been, there's no way my mum was going to let me do that, really.
You mentioned that for your father's death, music was a way of sort of coming to terms or understanding that. And yeah, then being a teenager, I remember, I'm a little bit older than you, I think. So for me, Bowie was the big idol, 72, 73. Yeah. But he provided a world which I felt I wanted to get into rather than the world I was in. Was that the same for you musically then?
I think so. I mean, it's funny, Bowie, I did buy, the first Bowie record I bought was there was a reissue of Space Oddity, which must have been about 74, 75, 76. I'm not sure, but mid-70s it came out again. It already, you know, it'd been out a few years earlier and been a hit, I think. But it was a hit again. And I bought that, and it had Velvet Goldmine and Changes on the B-side. And I actually like the B-side more than the A-side. I used to play those two songs all the time. And when I look at it, those two songs are kind of, especially Velvet Goldmine. Velvet Goldmine's not that different to punk, really. It's kind of edging its way towards a punkier sound. And I vividly remember going into Tony the Barber's in Horsford Town Street with my mate Cameron and my mate Paul. And we all said, "Mister, can we have a Bowie, please?" And we wanted the Bowie haircut. And this must have been about 74. It was when he was kind of Ziggy period, or maybe actually probably a Lad Insane period by then, you know. And I had red hair. I was a natural redhead. So, you know, when to see a pop star with red hair after being taunted for, you know, Ginger Nut and Duracell and all these kind of things, to suddenly see probably the coolest man in pop at that time, a red-haired guy, you know, even though it was dyed, you know, I'm like, yes, you know. So I want it to look like David Bowie. And I've still got pictures of the results of what happened when I came out of the barbers, and I looked like a kind of deranged Elvis. You know, my hair wouldn't go. It couldn't get it to go like Cameron and Paul had these super spiky Bowie mullets, you know. And I came out with this kind of weird quiff thing, and my mum's like, "What have you done at your hair?" You know, the first of many, many hairstyle horrors to come, unfortunately, my poor mum. I wanted in. I did want in, even though I wasn't cool enough. I couldn't quite hack it, really. But I had, you know, I got high waistband trousers and stuff like that, you know.
I remember having a Bowie haircut, and one morning a Ziggy Stardust haircut. One morning I went to school, and a sort of mile from my home at the next stop where this other school children, where they got on, suddenly they all shouted out Linda McCartney, and I was completely gutted because I thought I was David Bowie.
Yeah, anyhow, that's the sort of thing.
Let's get to the book, because the book appears in a way, it's a bit like a fanzine. You know, in its look.
I guess it is, yeah. I should say, I had nothing to do with the design whatsoever. I left it to people who do these things much better than I would. So, yeah, I suppose it does a bit, yeah, yeah.
Well, I think one of the great things about it is it's got this sort of timeless aspect to it because of that, and also because of the photographs. But tell me, how did the book actually come about in the first place?
The book came about... It's all a bit of a blur. Like, you probably realise that a lot of my life is like this. And I try and piece it together. And I think, when did that happen? And then when did this happen? But it was probably, I think, about May of 2021. And I got a phone call. Actually, it might have been initially a Facebook message, but I remember speaking on the phone to one of my mates, who was another journalist, another music journalist I've known for years. And he said, would you be interested in writing a Pistols book? You know, and I'm like, I don't know why, you know, and I'm still not entirely sure. Next time I speak to him, I'll have to ask him. It was either he was supposed to do it and didn't have the time, and so needed somebody else to take it on, or he was acting as a sort of intermediary for the publisher. And I'm not actually sure. I can't remember what was said at that, because it's all a blur of that conversation. But for whatever, you know, basically the deal was, it needed to be done by October. I think it was October the 31st. And I'm thinking, well, hang on. My previous two books, The Fallen and The Last Champions, both took 2 years each. So you want me to do a book in, what, 5 months? You know, and but it was, or is, a third of the length of either of those two books. So I'm thinking, okay, so I did 90,000 words for The Fallen, or actually, it might be even more than that, in 2 years. I did The Last Champions, probably 100,000+ in about that same time. So you start doing the maths, you know, you think, okay, 5 months, that's quite a tall order, you know. And I quickly realised I wouldn't have done what I did with both those books. The Fallen was, it talks to all the, well, most of the people that ever played in The Fall. And I tracked them all down, you know, about 45 or 50 of them in the end. And that took a long time. And I interviewed them all. In some cases, I went all over the place with The Last Champions. I even went to Los Angeles to speak to Vinnie Jones for that book. And I realized, I thought, that I'm not going to be able to do that in the time period with the amount of people I would like to speak for the Pistols book. However, I realized I was sitting on a big archive of, I've been interviewing people in and around punk for 20 years, you know, and I've interviewed John Lydon, well, Rotten, as you know, Johnny Rotten twice. People like Jar Wobble, I'd interviewed Glenn Matlock, Jimmy Percy, lots of the people are in and around that scene. And I had loads of this stuff, you know, unused quotes, some used, some not, some tapes in the garage, some on MP3s. And I thought, I've got quite a lot of stuff there. And I thought, right, I'll see what I've got, and then I'll see what I need, you know. And I kind of basically just thought, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it. And actually, I really, really enjoyed it. And what I decided to do, I thought, well, given the, I mean, I suppose ideally I would have loved 2 or 3 years to track down hundreds of people. But in the time period, I thought, right, what I really want is one or two people who've never spoken before or who've not really spoken properly that are quite key to the story. So I got a couple of those. I mean, I had a fascinating chat with Andrew Logan, who's quite a sort of well-known artist, sculptor, used to do the alternative Miss World, a real character. He put on the Pistols' second ever gig. And there's very little about it anywhere. And I thought, you know, I've got to ask him stuff. And we had a fantastic conversation. And he was hilarious and really giving and remembered, you know, he's a bit like me. There's some things he just didn't remember at all about it, and other things he could remember in really great detail. And then also I wanted to find people that had seen him, because I've been fascinated. I mean, I live in Yorkshire, and I'm fascinated by the fact that they played the Ford Green Pub in Leeds and Knickers Club in Keighley and a place in North Allerton, which is only like half an hour from me. And they played in Scarborough and places like this and Penzance. And I thought, I'll find a few people that went to those gigs and saw them playing, you know, under assumed names a lot of the time, playing to 30 people. What's it like? You know, what is it like when you see, you know, one of the most controversial bands in British pop history in a pub in Whitby or somewhere? You know, I just had to find 2 or 3 of those people, and they didn't disappoint, you know, and it placed it in context, really, because I think this is the thing that is probably hard for people now to get their head round, because nowadays, a band like the Pistols, if they came along, they would be everywhere. You know, there'd be such a media thing. There'd be a blitz of interest. There'd be all on lots of online stuff. Everything would go viral. There'd be loads of people wanting to get into the gigs. In the 70s, it wasn't like that. You know, I mean, in our school, there were probably 6 or 7 punks, tops. You know, everyone else was into Queen or whatever. And then,
but also, I think when you say context, I think the context, the political and social context of the era is pretty important. So, I mean, could you tell me about that, that what it was like during that era before they really sort of kicked in?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I think this is why the Pistols spoke to me as a teenager. Well, barely a teenager, you know, really. I think when they formed, they formed in 1975, I would have been about 11. Actually not even that. About 11, just 11, 12. So a very young child, but feeling, I can remember, and I still kind of feel like this. I felt annoyed at stuff. You know, I didn't like the way the world was. I didn't like the fact that my dad had died. I didn't like the fact that we didn't have a lot of money. other people lived in nicer houses and you would see them on the school route and you think, why is the world like this? You know, why is it so unfair? Why is there no natural justice in around on anything? And I was starting to become politically aware, but probably not in a detail way. But I'd started to watch the news and I used to see stuff like, you know, litter piling up in the streets and strikes, and it felt pretty crap, really. You know, my life didn't feel fantastic at that period. And I think really the Sex Pistols and bands like the Sex Pistols, Joy Division was another one a little bit later on, really connected with a sense that I had of frustration and that it was not all it cracked up to be. And I remember a kid at school saying, quoting that lyric from God Save the Queen, you know, where the flowers in your dustbin, and saying, that's exactly how it feels, isn't it? That's exactly how we feel. And I remember hearing that and thinking, it is. That is exactly how we feel. We felt like we'd been, as a generation, kind of let down a little bit. That it had been great in the 50s and 60s for young people. And by the late 70s, everything was, you know, I remember Britain as a black and white monochrome grey place. And I remember being very poor and it was just no fun. You know, we made our own fun. And so you'd do stuff like play on an upturned Mini Cooper and cut your leg. You know, I remember things like that, climb the local trees. And I kind of liked all that. I did like that. But yeah, we were, I think a lot of us felt frustrated. And so when punk came along, it was an outlet for that. And you just thought, finally, you know, these people understand how we, you know, I thought, perhaps naively, really, but that if somebody had drainpipe jeans and spiky hair, they were like me and they understood how I felt, and the music that they made would understand how I felt. And I think we all felt a bit like that, really. It just really resonated with kids and, you know, young people. And at the same time, and when I started researching the book, and, you know, it brought back memories. I do remember seeing stuff in the newspapers about these outrageous punk rockers, you know, and that how horrible they were and all the rest of it. And I'm thinking, no, they're not. These are the good people. You know, these are the people who are going to change the world. You're the reactionary forces, you know, and that really resonated with me. And it's funny looking back, but when I started digging into it and you find these kind of quotes from people in the Houses of Parliament or councillors or whatever, you know, about these outrageous, appalling punk rockers who deserve to be buried under the ground, you know, really negative stuff. It reminded me of that sort of sense of us and them I had. I mean, I remember a song, again, a couple of years later, but there was a song on the Metal Box album by Public Image called The Suit. And it was about some, you know, a kind of archetypal businessman. You know, I am the suit. You know, this is my nature. And I used to see people in suits as the enemy. You know, I thought they were everything I hated, everything I didn't want to be. I did not want to, you know, I think my career path from some of my family, they'd have been quite happy if I'd followed my dad into the civil service. And he was, you know, he was a tax collector for the revenue. And, you know, that job got him a council house. It didn't exactly set him up for life. I don't know how much he enjoyed it. I would love to know. You know, he had some lovely workmates there because I've seen the pictures. But, you know, I just thought, I don't want to do that. I don't want a job behind a desk. I don't want to be stuck in a suit. So it was everything I didn't like. And so punk just, you know, spoke to that sense of polarization from the society, I suppose, you know.
Yeah, a lot of people sort of romanticize about younger era, but when people talk to me about like the late 70s, early 80s, or the 70s and 80s, I always say that, well, the things that were really around them were homophobia, racism, misogyny. It was a really pretty evil time.
I mean, that, you know, again, slightly later on, but around 83, by the time I'd been in, you know, just about old enough to get into pubs, I remember that was when the Falklands War was all kicking off. And me and my mate would sit on the upstairs bus of the bus coming back from Leeds City Centre on a Friday or Saturday. And there'd be people like, why aren't you in the Falklands? Why aren't you over there with our boys? And all this stuff, you know. And I thought, well, I'd rather listen to Echo and the Bunnymen, thanks very much. I'm not a part of this. And I hated it. And I still, you know, it's funny because talking about it now, I don't feel that differently now. I haven't really lost that sense of, you know, indignation at a lot of things that go on. And yeah, I mean, I got into the Gang of Four, the Clash, and they started opening my eyes to politics, you know, and a different way of thinking, I think, really, a different way of thinking. There was a brilliant line in a Gang of Four song. We all have opinions. Where do they come from? And it was actually a line from a feminist pamphlet that Andy Gill from the Gang of Four had found somewhere near Leeds University. But that really hit home, you know, and I thought, that's so true. Because, for example, my mom, bless her, you know, she would say, oh, the flipping IRA, you know, because the IRA bombings were on the news a lot. And she was very anti the IRA. But you start to realise it's not as black and white as that. These are very complex situations. And it's not as simple as good and bad or black and white. And, you know, you just find that the world is a lot more nuanced. And you're obviously, your mind's starting to change at that point. And the Clash got me into reggae music. And, you know, listening to different forms of music, and so that I was opening my mind in that way. Really, in some ways, it was an awful time. It was a bleak time, but equally, I have to say, the excitement of discovering new music was it just felt incredible. And the first the first gig I went to, apart from the Jam soundcheck incident, was Futurama in Leeds, which was 1979, headlined by Public Image. And the only reason I went to that was because I wanted to see Johnny Rotten. You know, I was still quite young then, and I went to that. You know, it was on a Saturday. I had to finish early from my Saturday job. And it was just like one after another band blowing my mind. You know, Cabaret Voltaire with all their weird synthesizer music, A Certain Ratio with their punky funk stuff, Punishment of Luxury, theatrical post-punk new wave. Just one band after another. Orchestra Maneuvers in the Dark with, I think, the first band I saw, actually. They sounded like the Magic Roundabout Theme from Outer Space. And it was just like one after another. And all these people around me, all of the who were older than me and my friend, all of who looked cooler than we were. I had an iron-on Sid Vicious t-shirt when I went to that gig. It was never worn again. I changed, everything changed overnight. I went to Scene and Nerd Records in Leeds and bought Joy Division's Transmission single on the Monday morning. And yeah, everything changed. Everything changed. And that moment, it all crystallized, because punk was about this kind of rage thing, really, or frustration. And then suddenly Futurama was about possibility, and the two things kind of dovetailed and totally changed my life, really. So,
you know, back to the book, and the first chapter is basically this interview with Bill Grundy, who had a Today program, which is this infamous interview, and anyone in Britain will know it completely. Yeah. And it does sort of, because of the context of the time, which you sort of mentioned, it sort of, in that context, when you read it in that context, you can see a little bit where the reaction came from. Today, it's a bit odd to read that. Can you tell me about that interview and why you decided that should open the book?
I think because it just sums it up. That was the moment that they went from being a, you know, I suppose a cult thing in London, known by a small handful, to front page news and a national outrage, you know, overnight because of that program. I didn't see the program because we wouldn't have got it where I live, but I do remember it being on the front page. I remember the front pages, you know, the next day when it all kicked off, the filth and the fury and all this, you know, I do remember that. But it just sort of, watching it now, it sums up the...
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The sense of them and us, and the sense of something had arrived that the establishment or the media didn't know how to tackle. They'd never had anything like this before. And you really get a sense of that when you look at the Bill Grundy program, because, you know, the interviewer, Bill Grundy, is clearly sort of slightly bemused by this phenomenon around him, slightly, possibly slightly intimidated by it and slightly scornful, you know. And so he's kind of trying to find ways of almost like putting them down, really. And it becomes this confrontation between almost like the old and the new, you know. And I love that about it. I love the fact that, you know, they went on there, and however long that clip lasts, it's not that long, it's only a few minutes, you know. And in those few minutes, change everything. They changed their lives. They changed Bill Grundy's life, who never really worked in television again. They changed the media narrative, and they changed, you know, the minds of so many young people, and just created this ripple that is still spreading. And it, in a way, it all starts with that appearance.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Has there ever been an entrance like that by a band anywhere near comparable? Because when I read that, I thought... Mm. Oh, God, that is, you know, I mean, I forgot how wild the reaction was and how explosive the reaction was. And then with, you know, everybody, you know, them getting banned from radio stations, from everything, was so over the top. Yeah. And at the same time, as being someone of a younger generation back then, it was immediately something, oh, wow, this is fantastic.
You know, absolutely. The only thing I can compare it to, and I wasn't there, but, you know, I've read about and I've seen the clips of Elvis, you know, when Elvis was first broadcast on American television, and it caused such outrage across the nation that, you know, they banned him from being filmed from the waist down, because below the waist would cause such damage to society and the fabric of the nation and the minds of the nation's youth that it wasn't allowed to show it from the waist. And that's the only thing that I think is comparable, really. And but certainly nothing in my lifetime has been comparable to that. You know, it's, you know, there's been sort of a sort of similar thing, like Huggy Bear on the Word springs to mind. And, you know, the Stone Roses on The Late Show I think it must have been about 1989 or 1990 when they blow the power and everything. And that was quite a moment. But, yeah, nothing, you know, the Bill Grundy, certainly in my lifetime, it's the top of the tree in terms of instant impact and instant outrage. Amazing, really.
How unlikely do you think the members of the original, you know, the first members of the Sex Pistols were to be a band? How unlikely was that from their backgrounds?
This is the other side of it. And there's a great quote that John Wardle, aka Jar Wobble, told me a few years ago that I put in the book, that, you know, when he said, I think when Johnny Rotten, his friend John, had basically said, you know, I'm joining this band, and Wobble said that, you know, for us it was as likely as flying a 747 that you would be in a band. And when you look at the original four Pistols, and arguably Sid Vicious, the fifth member, as it were, or the first in, after the departure, the first lineup change, well, the only lineup change really, but arguably Sid as well. None of these people were people that you would have expected to be in a band. Steve Jones, and I love Steve Jones's book, and that had a big impact on me writing this. I thought he really captures a lot of that sense that, you know, he was a miscreant, he was a thief, he was a real, you know, a ne'er-do-well, as my mum might have called him. You know, he stole the equipment from, you know, this various gigs and everything. He was not a person you would expect to form a band at a time when bands meant musicianship and proficiency and, you know, virtuoso guitar playing and solos that went on for 5 years. You know, Rotten himself, you know, he'd had a terrible childhood with meningitis and a coma and all the rest of it, and had to educate himself, probably virtually unemployable otherwise, apart from being the singer in the Sex Pistols, for which he was completely brilliantly qualified. Paul Cook was probably the most regular of the band in some ways. He had a steady job, working as a sort of electrician, but gave that up for the band. He was possibly, you know, I guess working class kids from reasonably stable backgrounds did go into bands. And Cookie and Glenn Matlock, I think, had slightly more stable backgrounds than the other two. But really, bands weren't, they didn't look like that in 1976 and 77. They didn't, certainly didn't sound like that. You know, they weren't brilliantly proficient. However, you know, Paul Cook was a really good drummer in for the Sex Pistols, you know, and he's become quite a good in-demand session drummer in the end. And Steve Jones had a very, very influential and distinctive sound. And, you know, even though it might not have been as technically proficient as, you know, the people that you'd see on Top of the Pops every week and, you know, the sort of virtuoso prog rock guitar heroes, etc. But it was a very exciting sound. And yeah, that maybe that's all you need, you know.
Well, obviously, you know, and also McLaren, Malcolm McLaren, but he was sort of distinct in age and in the type of person he was.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is another thing that I suppose I slightly wanted to kind of not set the record straight, but kind of just clarify and bring a few things together. There is a consensus a common view that the Pistols were somehow manufactured by McLaren as this evil Svengali who would rip off the record business. It's not really like that. For a start, the bulk of the band were together before they met McLaren. You know, the first Sex Pistol really was a guy called Wally Nightingale, who's you know, been sort of forgotten in the mist of history. But it was him that started the band that Steve Jones and Paul Cook and then eventually Glenn Matlock got going. They weren't called the Sex Pistols. They have various names, but they were called Swankers for a lot of the time. And, you know, it doesn't have quite the same ring of it. But, you know, McLaren sort of, he didn't put it together. They started going in his shop basically, and then he realized that they could be a band, or they were a band, but there could be more. And you know, they needed a frontman, and Lyde and Johnny Rotten, as would be, had started going in the shop. So it wasn't really planned. And the other thing which is really striking is that for all the controversy, when the Grundy incident first went off, Malcolm McLaren was terrified. It was like, what the heck have we done? What have we done? You know, this will be the end of us. And it was only, you know, it was like a few hours later or the next day, really, he started to realise, oh, actually, no, this could be a good thing. Controversy. But they'd not deliberately gone out to be controversial. It wasn't like they were going to plan this. You know, the Bill Grundy incident was not planned. It wasn't like we're going to go on and we're going to outrage the nation and land on the front pages. It was a kind of accident, really, that happened. And Steve Jones actually says it was the worst thing that could happen to the group, because it changed, you know, from that moment they were public enemy number one and in the spotlight. So they weren't allowed to develop naturally in the way that a group would have done. And that fascinates me. What would have happened had the Pistols gone that way? Would they have made 10 albums? We've no idea. We'll never know. But for whatever reason, well, for the Grundy reason, it all changed, and suddenly they were in the focus, in the spotlight, and everyone would have an opinion on them forever. Then, you know, nobody has a kind of, you know, you either love or the hate, or you hate the Sex Pistols. Certainly in 1977, it was polarized. You know, nobody was in the middle. Ultimate bandmate.
I mean, one thing you've already touched on about them playing and people going to their gigs and changing their life, but what really comes across in the book is all these fledgling future rock and pop stars, or whatever you want to call them, who are at their gigs, and suddenly it changed their life. Can you tell me about that?
I find that incredible. And it's funny, even since I wrote the book, I've interviewed more people that have said, you know, oh, I saw the Sex Pistols in 1977 and it changed my, you know, Martin Fry from ABC was one of them. And you think, well, hang on, how do you go from Nevermind the Bollocks to The Look of Love? You know, it seems poles apart. But that was the great thing that they did, was they convinced a lot of working class, especially working class kids up and down the country, we can do this. We can form a band. You know, we can do it. We don't have to sound like that. We can do it our way. And so ABC would develop. Green Gartside from Scritti Politti, another band who don't really sound anything like the Sex Pistols, saw the gig at Leeds Polytechnic. And literally, he told me it changed his life. You know, it just never was the same again. And he knew what he wanted to do from that moment on. There's loads of them. You know, Joy Division were at the two Manchester gigs is pretty much a who's who of music in Manchester, the people that attended those two gigs. You know, everybody from Joy Division to Mick Hucknall was at that, or one of the two Manchester gigs. Obviously, the Buzzcocks supported them at the second, and they promoted the first gig, because Howard Devoto and Pete Shelley, Pete McNeish and Howard Trafford, as they were then called, saw them in High Wycombe and said to Malcolm McLaren, could we put your band on in Manchester? You know, so they bring the Pistols up to Manchester, and that starts punk in Manchester, really, that gig, the first time at the Lesser Free Trade Hall. And it's just all these like ripples, really. And I love the fact that, you know, people like Polystyrene saw them playing under the pier at Hastings, on the pier at in Hastings, with about, you know, 20, 30 people watching, and She Forms X-Ray Specs. Penetration from County Durham saw them at North Allerton, in one of the tiny little gigs, and they formed Penetration. You know, it feels like, you know, there's that story about, I think it was Brian Eno had that quote about the Velvet Underground, you know, that they didn't sell many records, but everyone who bought one formed a seminal band or something like that. It feels a little bit like that with the Pistols, that certainly at the start, a lot of people that saw them had their lives completely transformed by it. And I think those ripples carry on, you know, not just in music. You know, people like Damien Hirst is a big Sex Pistols fan. So that's the art world. You know, Kerry McCarthy, the MP for, I think, Bristol, one of the Bristol constituencies, is a punk and Sex Pistols fan. And, you know, it's just all these tentacles, you know, going to all these different areas. And I love that.
I mean, you mentioned that they're working class, and what I never really thought of it before, and it's in the book, that their contemporaries in America were middle class.
Yeah. I did a talk a couple of weeks ago, and I got a kind of question I hadn't really expected, really, about, you know, American punk and British punk. And, you know, did the Americans start punk? And I thought, heck, I didn't see that one coming. And I wasn't even sure if I'd ever really thought of it before. But how I explained it, or my view of it really, is that I don't see them as the same things. I don't see British punk has a lot in common with American punk. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the American bands did tend to be more middle class. But also, I think they had different concerns and a different sound. I mean, one of the first records I bought actually was the 12-inch of Blank Generation by Richard Hell and the Voidoids. And I bought that purely on the strength of the picture on the cover, which is Richard Hell with a fantastic kind of punky, spiky haircut, and his eyes are cut out. It looks really... It just looked punky, really, to a 13-year-old. It's like I'm going to buy that. I had no idea. I didn't know they were American. I didn't know anything about them. I just bought the 12-inch, and I got it home, and I thought, oh, doesn't really sound very punk. This, it doesn't sound punk at all. I did really like it, and I love the idea of a Blank Generation. You know, that I suppose that possibly could have been a British punk song, that in the title, but the music didn't sound punk at all. And yeah, I don't really see the that much in common in a way. I mean, I love the Ramones, and I saw the Ramones when I'll have been about 16, I think, and it was one of the best gigs I saw in that period. I remember coming home drenched in sweat, you know. But were the Ramones punk? Not in the way that we understand it over here. You know, it's certainly got that same energy, you know, but and short songs and all the rest of it and leather jackets, but not quite in the same way that we understand punk. You know, there's not a lot in common between, you know, if you look at television, Talking Heads, Patti Smith, Ramones and stuff like the Pistols and X-Ray Specs, etc. You know, there's an overlap, but they're quite different in a lot of ways. And maybe the class thing is part of it. You know, maybe it is. You know, I think maybe the British version was a little bit more of a rudimentary whale, you know.
I was talking to Kevin Heggie the other week, who's a documentary maker, and he made that fantastic documentary, New Romantics. And he was also talking about Andrew Logan.
Yeah.
And the Sex Pistols playing. And Andrew Logan, of course, did the alternative, was it Miss Universe or Miss World?
Alternative Miss World.
Yeah, the alternative Miss World at that yeah. time. Why was that such a pivotal appearance for the Sex Pistols?
I think because there was a lot of people at that gig that were kind of movers and shakers and things like that. And I think Andrew Logan's parties were quite notorious and memorable for that. You know, they would attract a lot of the kind of arty people in London and, you know, real characters. So for them to be part of that scene gives them a sort of arty kind of context that maybe they wouldn't have normally been exposed to. And I think also just the fact that it was a Valentine's Day ball put on in an art installation type space, not the kind of place you would normally get a rock band, you know. And I think by putting them in an unusual place, it kind of gives them a different context, you know. I mean, arguably Public Image Limited took that on because they started really expanding the ideas of what a rock band is and what, you know, even what records are. You know, they put out 3 12-inches in a tin, you know, and they had this idea that they would be a limited company with different members, you know, and they were really playing around with the idea of what a band was. And I think maybe Andrew Logan's world maybe sowed some of that seed, you know, because it was a very different world to where they would have come from, you know, which would have been pubs and, you know, record shops maybe.
I mean, you mentioned in the book that they're banned, they're vilified in the press, they're obviously loved by a certain section of society at the same time. They're banned from gigging, you know, there's threats all over the place. Yeah. And then there are the internal conflicts within the band. What do you think the actual beginning of the end was? What was it because of the internal conflicts, or was it the outside influence on them?
It's kind of both, and I think they're fed into each other. I mean, I suppose the internal conflicts, Cook and Jones went back a long way. They were childhood mates. You know, they hung around together. They knew each other very, very well. Glenn Matlock was the only one of the band who went to a grammar school. So he was a slightly different, and he had a much more stable background from than Cook and Jones. And he had much more of a kind of, you know, musical, probably breadth of his vocabulary was a bit broader musically. He wasn't really quite like them. And nor was Lydon, you know. So they were quite different characters. So I think it's always different. I mean, you know, I think in any band, it's very hard to find people that don't just gel musically, but gel as people. And to keep that together is probably the hardest part of it. It's very difficult, I think, when you're not very successful, because people get frustrated, you know, why aren't we playing there? Why aren't we in this magazine? And then when success comes, it brings other pressures. Why is the front man always on the front of the magazine? Why is it always this? Why do they always interview the singer? You know, you get all these different pressures build up in bands. So you've got all those normal pressures, and then you've got the the relentlessness of what it must have been like to be in the Pistols in that kind of public eye, all those things you mentioned, and for Cook and Jones, they would have loved to tour and play gigs, and suddenly they're not allowed to play gigs. You know, they're banned from everywhere. That would have been frustrating. And they would get attacked. You know, they got most of the band got attacked in the street at one point or another, you know, quite severely. So they were getting all these kind of things, you know, that would just exaggerate any kind of problems. So the first real fault line that went was Matlock. You know, Matlock was becoming more and more alienated, I think, from the rest of the band, and especially Rotten. You know, there was a big conflict there between the two of them. So he basically was the first one who, you know, he wanted out, really, and was getting more and more frustrated with it. So then they get in Sid, who, you know, bless him, was not a stable enough person to cope with any. Well, I don't know if Sid Vicious would have really been the right person to get in many groups at all, but certainly not a band as volatile and as in the eye of the storm as the Pistols were. And with all the problems that resulted as a result, you know, I mean, Wobble described Sid Vicious as a very damaged boy. You know, he was with him when they went to see, Sid Vicious was sent to see a sort of psychiatrist, you know, and you know, they were sort of joking about suicide and stuff like that, you know, and, you know, but really, it wasn't that much of a joke for Sid. It probably was for Wobble, because he wasn't really suicidal, but Sid was, or certainly he had that kind of nihilistic darkness in him. And he went down some dark paths, and then you've got that person in the band, not very proficient musically. You know, could never really play the bass. They did try to get him, you know, Lemmy tried to teach him at one point, but was obviously very iconic visually for the band, but again became a target of various things. And it just, I don't know, I don't think any band would have survived in that environment. I just don't know how you could have done, you know, because it's hard enough being in a band and all the pressures of rehearsing and playing gigs and being into all those kind of things that normally go in a band. But if you've got all that with this constant negativity and constant stuff like being banned and, you know, being attacked, etc., I just don't know how you would hold it together. It's, in a way, it's a miracle it lasted as long as they did. You know,
yeah, I mean, you mentioned Sid Vicious's troubled history. I mean, yeah. His mother was a heroin addict.
Yeah.
Of course, he's going out with Nancy Spungen, who's sort of aligned in a sense by lots of people to Yoko Ono as the you know, the person that brought down the band. Yeah, the Wicked Witch of the West, which I don't necessarily think is all true, because it was already happening. So
I mean, I think she was certainly a very, you know, nihilistic person herself, and her mother's book, that, you know, I Don't Want to Live This Life, you know, that's the title of the book, and seems to sum up, you know, she was clearly very damaged, and they bonded together because of that. You know, and it does seem to be that when she came on the scene that things with Sid went downhill rapidly, you know, in terms of heroin and stuff like that. It's a real shame, you know, because, you know, he's the human tragedy at the core of this thing, you know. And I think, you know, a lot of the people around feel very guilty or bad about what happened to Sid, really. You know, whether he would, it might have happened to him anyway, but it probably just sped it up a bit. But we'll never know.
I mean, I was talking the other day about Joy Division to someone, and we were talking about the fact that when Ian Curtis died, or the fact that he died, sort of added to their legacy, because they had a limited amount of material that was out. How do you see the legacy of the Sex Pistols in relation to the end of the band, which you sort of put in the book as the San Francisco gig, and the fact that they could be no more?
Well, I wanted to stop the book at that moment. I didn't want to go into the various reunions and all the rest of it. So I stopped the book when the band end, and then when Sid dies, you know, not that long afterwards. So those are the two real incidents that bring the curtain down. I think at the time, the mythology around Sid Vicious was very, very powerful and very strong. And then, you know, you'd get these, I remember seeing badges in Leeds Market, you know, Sid Vicious, too fast to live, too young to die and stuff like that. And he had that James Dean status that Ian Curtis then had, where, you know, a young death. It seems to be very romantic and very appealing to a lot of people. I think that's gradually faded, really. I don't think that's as big a part of the mythology of the Pistols now as it would have been at the time. I think really ultimately that, you know, and it's the same for Joy Division, you know, that what really makes them last is the impact on people and the body of work. And the Pistols left a fairly small body of work, certainly in the original, you know, not there's various compilations, reissues, but the actual output at the time was pretty tiny in terms of a handful of singles and one record, one album. But they're all fantastic and they made a powerful impact. And it was the same for Joy Division, you know, two albums, you know, not discounting the live album and all the rest of it, but two albums and a handful of singles. And both bands not seen by many people, you know, both bands weren't playing big gigs. They weren't playing, I mean, Joy Division did a lot more than the Pistols, but they weren't in the scheme of things, they weren't seen by as many people as you would expect in the way that, if a band blows up now, you know, Arctic Monkeys, Nirvana, whoever, you know, that they end up being seen by thousands and thousands of people. And for the Pistols and Joy Division, it was very, very few people. I was lucky enough to see Joy Division. And I only saw the Pistols after they reformed, you know, unfortunately. But yeah, I think they had a massive impact on the people that they impacted at the time. And that's just grown and grown, really. And it's funny, the Ian Curtis thing, because it did sort of, it kind of, his lyrics suddenly made sense a little bit. You know, there was that line in New Dawn Fades, a loaded gun won't set you free, so they say, you know. And I remember even before he died, like that line sort of, you're leaping out, what's that about, you know. And then when he dies, you suddenly think that's what it was about, you know. He was sort of pondering going. It's very weird to think like that at a young age, when, you know, that somebody who wasn't that much older than I was had decided to get out, you know. And it's I think that as young people, that had a big effect on a lot of people I knew, because you just didn't know people who did that. You know, no one gets off the train. You know, it just didn't happen. We'd no experience of that. And so it was very startling and shocking for a lot of us. And then obviously when you get older, you start to realize what it was, you know, what it was about. I've had friends that have, you know, committed suicide, and it's, yeah, it affects you.
What's the one aspect that you discovered whilst writing this book about the Sex Pistols that surprised you or sort of hit you in the face or whatever, you know?
I think more than anything is the smallness of it all at the time. And I know Nevermind the Bollocks was a hit and all the rest of it, and they were on Top of the Pops. But when you think that a band are this, you know, cultural phenomenon, really, you know, in terms of British culture, were playing below a bingo hall in Whitby at the height of their infamy, and somebody is telling them to be quiet because they're disrupting the bingo, you just think, how on earth do you go from there to where they are in terms of history? But I love that. I love the fact that they were playing Knickers and Keighley and, you know, clubs in Northallerton and to handfuls of people when the outside world were up in outrage. You know, there was like the actual thing was going on in a room of 30 people or whatever. And I absolutely love that fact. Finding out the scale of that and the amount of small gigs they played and the relative few big gigs they played really brought that home to me, that this was actually quite a small phenomenon at the time, but it's just developed this. It's like throwing a stone into the river, you know. It just causes the ripples, and the ripples keep growing. And here we are, you know, 45 years later, and the ripples are still growing. They're still carrying on. And I love that about it. I love that about the story, you know, that it's not really over.
Yeah, well, it's a fantastic read. And I love the fact that you really get to understand their contribution and their influence on so many people directly, you know, because of these gigs where you, you know, say who's there and everything, a direct influence. And it's just a great read. So Dave Simpson, author of Sex Pistols, I Want to Be Me. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Rachel Fisher.
And I'm Desi Jenikin.
And we're the hosts of Hollywood Crime Scene. We're really excited to announce that we're launching a new podcast called Bitch Slap, where we explore one of our passions, nighttime soaps.
Every week, we will be recapping episodes of a classic nighttime soap, starting with one of the greatest shows of all time, Melrose Place.
That's Bitch Slap. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
It's the most wonderful time of the year, Christmas. And what better way to get into the holiday spirit than with a Minky Couture blanket? Whether you're gathered around the tree with loved ones, roasting marshmallows by the fire, or just looking for a cozy way to stay warm on a chilly night, Minky blankets are the perfect addition to your Christmas festivities. With a wide range of festive designs and colors, you can find the perfect blanket to match your holiday decor or gift to your loved ones. So this Christmas, make your holiday even cozier with a Minky Couture blanket. Head to MinkyCouture.com now and find your perfect blanket just in time for the holiday. Happy holidays from Minky Couture.
At Sleep Outfitters Outlet, great sleep is a big deal. Save 40 to 60% every day on every Sealy, Stearns & Foster, and Tempur-Pedic. Queens as low as $249. Customer exchanges, closeouts, and floor samples. Inventory changes daily, so come in for your dream deal today. With no credit needed financing, expert advice, and up to 60% off retail, it's never been easier to get the sleep and savings you deserve. Go to sleepoutfittersoutlet.com for financing details and to find a store near you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.